Hello again, and welcome back to the Podcast of Steel. I am your host, Luke Bug, the Geek of Steel, and this is a special episode of sorts. I thought that I had lost this interview and video with the wonderful writer Mark Waid, but thankfully I found it, and I'm so happy that I can get to watch it again and just enjoy it. I've enjoyed Mark Waid's writing so many times over the years, whether it be Kingdom Come, which we talked about a lot, or, of course, Superman Birthright. To be able to sit down with this wonderful man and learn more about his life and about what Superman means to him was a joy. As you know, I love asking people, what does Superman mean to you? And for me to be able to ask that question to Mark Waid was, and still is, such a big highlight in the life of the Geek of Steel and Luke Bug. So please enjoy this brand new episode of an old episode of the Podcast of Steel with my very special guest, Mark Waid. Hello again, Luke Bug, the Geek of Steel. And today I am joined by comic writer Mark Waid. Hello, sir.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast and tell my listeners and me, basically this is just me geeking out and fanboying because I'm speaking today. I mean, you've done so much over the years, but eventually in the podcast, I'd love to talk to you about Kingdom Come, which I have my dog-eared copy right there next to me, and also my Superman Birthright as well. But first of all, sir, what's your origin story? How did you land in comics?
When I was about 3 years old, the Batman TV show with Adam West came on, and my dad recognized Batman from his childhood, thought it might be something I'd be interested in, which was an understatement, and it never stopped after that. I was an only child for until I was about 7 years old, so my mother and my grandparents took a lot of time teaching me how to read, teaching me, teaching me how to read. So I was reading at a first grade level at age four, so, and reading at a 10th grade level about age six. So I was, comics was a huge part of that because that's how I learned to read, but that's also then what I consumed constantly at that point.
Yeah. And obviously, it's not a bad way to start into reading. It's how I got into reading. I think it's how many people get into, fiction and nonfiction. And for me, going back, it was the graphic novels in the library and reading things such as, not your classic comics, but books like Lord of the Rings and those graphic novels, books that I couldn't really grasp at a young age. But with time, graphic novels led me into a new world of reading, especially Superman comics as well. How did it become for you to start writing superhero, not just Superman, but super comics in general? How did that happen for you?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is I had no ambition of being a writer growing up. I really didn't. I was proficient with the language. I could write nonfiction. I wrote for, high school newspapers and college papers and stuff. So I knew I could handle that. But fiction just seemed like a scary animal to me. I didn't think you could possibly come up with as many ideas as you could possibly need to come up with for a comic book writer. So I wanted to be an editor. That was my goal. I wanted to be involved in comics, and I knew that it was very important to me that it be have something to do with Superman because he was by all means my favorite. But I went on staff as an editor at DC Comics. This is maybe 25, and stayed there for a while. And while I was there, because I was editing their anthology books like Secret Origins and so forth, I was editing scripts from every writer across the medium. So dozens and dozens of different writers, every writer that there was, all these scripts coming across my desk. As an editor, I learned more about writing in those 2 years than I would have on 10 years on my own. And so when I left that job to go freelance, I managed to make enough contacts with my fellow, peer editors up there where they wanted to use me afterwards when I went freelance. And it's been a ride ever since. I mean, I've been very lucky since then not to have to pick up the phone. Very, very lucky. But that, like I said, it never occurred to me that I'd want to write. I love superheroes, but it never occurred to me that I could write them until my first exposure to DC actually was selling an 8-page story to Julie Schwartz, who was the Superman editor in 1984. It's the greatest day of my professional life, actually, because Julie was one of the beginners, one of the founders of science fiction fandom in general in the 90s. And so he was always at heart looking out for fans and eager to give, you know, pay it forward and give fans the next leg up. So a lot of the people that we hired over the years were, you know, fans with you know, that had some talent. And I had met up with him because I was working in the fan press, working on magazines like Amazing Heroes and so forth. And interviewing editors for upcoming projects just to get, you know, their information, upcoming projects and so forth. I got to know Julie and I went in to sell him pitch an 8-page story and he bought it on the spot and it was the greatest day ever. And then I wrote it and it turned out okay. It wasn't great. It was a decent first story. Then I sold him another one that was terrible. Didn't come together at all. And then I went on staff. I mean, I hadn't at that point, you know, if I had any dreams of being a Superman writer at that point, you know, that experience, that second story being terrible, kind of shut that down. And then Julie retired in 86. So that was my contact there. So at that point, editorial seemed like the best way in to the industry in general.
Well, yeah, because I mean, it's given you so much wisdom. You've learned as you've progressed through the years and, you know, you've written for many titles, many characters and many companies. What sort of, from each job, when you went on to the next one, what piece of advice did you keep telling yourself to keep moving forward?
Wow, that's a good question. I just leave it all on the field. If that's, you know, it's an American expression, but it just means, you know, leave, don't hold back, put it all out there and invest in the characters that you're writing, invest emotionally, which is a double-edged piece of advice, because at the end of the day, you don't own these characters. At the end of the day, you know, whether or not you're able to work on these characters is up to the company, not you. And, you know, you can put all your energy and time into them and you don't necessarily get anything other than a paycheck. But as opposed to create your own stuff where it's yours and it, you know, you own it and you can, you benefit off your ideas for the rest of time and so forth. But that said, you know, I it never occurred to me then to give less and less effort to the non-creator-owned stuff than I did to my own creator-owned stuff. Because again, you have to really put yourself into those characters. You have to emotionally invest. You can't just write it like it's a job and it's a, you know, you're punching a clock. Readers can tell when you're doing it for a check versus when you're doing it because it means something to you emotionally. It shows in the stories. I know that one of the best pieces of advice I ever got actually was when I was on staff and Dick Giordano was my boss at the time. He was the executive editor at DC. He's a brilliant man. And I asked him once, because I was editing one of the books I'd inherited was, and I want to name a book name, but it was objectively bad. It was an objectively bad series. And I went to Dick and I said, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, I don't have any control over this series because I'm only the assistant editor on this series, but it's okay. But what baffles me is I enjoy it. Like it's objectively bad. And yet I enjoy reading in this comic. What's going on? And Dick said, it's because the person who was writing it would write it for free. And it shows. And he was absolutely right. It said, you can't fake that enthusiasm. It goes into the work. So, you know, back to your question about advice pushing forward, it was always give it all, because readers will be able to tell, your audience will be able to tell when you're not. Audience will be able to tell when you're holding back. The audience will be able to tell when you're not 100% invested. And then you just become a journeyman writer who nobody remembers.
And talking about leaving it all on the field, this Kingdom Come that I'm not sure how many times I've read over the years. I know it's a lot. It's a story that I can never put down. Emotion, storytelling, characters, action. It's got it all. A little bit of romance in there as well, just for good measure. How did this partnership between you and Alex Ross happen to make this wonderful book happen?
Well, really, the genesis was Alex. I mean, there's no question about that. He had just done that book called Marvels over at Marvel Comics with Kurt Busiek, being a painted 4-issue thing. And so DC had approached him. What can you have anything you want to do for us? And so Alex came to the table with the basic idea. It's many years in the future, you know, Superman's retired. Other heroes have come up. There's chaos. He had a few other ideas. He had a lot of sketches, but there was no real plot to it. And so he didn't feel confident writing it on his own. He wanted to hook up with somebody at DC. They brought me in, which was kind of surprising at the time. I didn't have a whole lot of credentials other than I knew all the DC characters. I was an encyclopedia of DC knowledge. At that point, I'd written the Impact Comics books, Shield, The Legend of the Shield and the Comet. I had been writing Flash for about an hour and a half. I don't remember how long it was, but it wasn't long. But they brought me into the meeting. Archie Goodwin was the editor at that time. And he and Alex and I and editor Dan Rasper went out to lunch. And Alex started telling me about his vision of the story. And it was big and bombastic, and I enjoyed it. And I remember being fascinated by the telling of it and his ideas and so forth, but it wasn't emotionally clicking for me yet. I didn't feel like, I don't know what I can bring to the table. And so we're talking. And talked about Superman at the end of the story, sort of, you know, returning to his Clark Kent identity once more, but things are better. And this image of him putting his glasses back on for the first time in the story, the very end, that image came into my head. And at that moment, I thought, okay, yeah, all right, that now I'm invested. Now I can start to see pictures in my head of what this could be. And so that's the moment I said, yeah, I'm in on this. And in fact, those pages, that sequence is the only piece of original Kingdom Come artwork I own, but it is framed in the house, the scene where Superman puts his glasses back on at the end. Yeah, so that's where that all came from. So then Alex and I, you know, went back and forth over the phone. I went to Chicago and stayed for a few days, and we just banged out the basic beats of things. And it was always a work in progress. I mean, issue by issue, we were always still fussing with things, and you know, in upcoming issues, we were fussing with plot points. We weren't quite sure exactly how the fourth issue was going to end or what the landing point was going to be. So it was never a case of, okay, we're done with the whole script, now Alex, go do it. It was, here's the first script, and Alex starts. And at that point, he does 10 pages a month, because that's his, like clockwork, that was his speed. And so I just better keep up. And so, you know, we were just constantly faxing stuff back and forth to each other, constantly calling each other on the phone and running ideas of scenes back and forth. And sometimes we were in agreement, and sometimes we weren't in agreement, but it was a good collaboration.
Yeah, two very different creative minds working together, not always
very, very different. Yeah,
not always in the same room as well. And they, like, this is pretty much before Zoom and Skype. You know, it was
yeah,
faxes.
Exactly, yeah,
and I'm pretty sure that even seeing some of Alex's sketches coming through a fax machine would be sort of mind blowing, because the art combined with the writing in this book, it's just, as you said, it's emotional writing. It's emotional storytelling, which is why it's just gotten so many awards over the years and still gets so much love, which I'm very happy about. How do you feel, even after all these years, being part of something that is literally changed the way that comics were told?
It's an amazing feeling. I mean, I'm always gratified for the feedback we get. I'm always quick to point out that, you know, if you credit me as the writer, that's not completely accurate, because Alex was, you know, in there, you know, co-plotting with me the whole time. So it wasn't, you know, I don't want to take all the credit there, but I think it's not my best work. It was my best work that I was capable of 25 years ago. I'm hopefully 25 years better now. But there's nothing about it that embarrasses me. There's nothing about it that I look back and wince at. I'm just proud people like it. I'm glad it really, you know, people responded to it. I'm very happy about that.
Well, and they still are.
I just wish they would stop using it as a direction finder for the DC universe. Because every once in a while, you know, more things about, hey, we'll look like more stuff from Kingdom Come is showing up in the present day DC continuity. And I'm always like, no, it's a cautionary fable. It's not supposed to be a roadmap. It's supposed to be, it's a terrible thing that's happening in Kingdom Come. But that amuses me. That's the only thing that I...
Yeah, it's not all laughs and good times in this book. There are some very dark moments indeed. But I mean, but as you said, it has been coming back. I mean, we've seen Brandon in the Kingdom Come suit, which the world went absolutely crazy for. I mean, I can remember, I think it was at San Diego Comic-Con when he ripped open his shirt and there was a Kingdom Come t-shirt underneath. I think a whole gasp went around the world in that exact moment.
Yeah.
Did they come to you for advice about any of those scenes or anything, or...?
Not the scene so much, but Mark Guggenheim and I are good friends. And about geez, I don't know, about four or five months before San Diego. We had dinner and we were just talking about what was coming up. He revealed that they were going to do Crisis, but they didn't have a whole lot of details. But he said, the funny thing is, we're having a hard time getting permission to use the Bryan Singer Superman costume. We might be able to do it, but in case we don't have permission lined up, we're thinking about the Kingdom Come one. He told me this at dinner, knowing I would, a big grin would come across my face. And I said, just make that happen. And so my enthusiasm for that just eclipsed his notions of using the Bryan Singer costume. Let's just go with Kingdom Come. And so it was kind of sealed at that dinner. And I knew it was coming for the longest time. I couldn't tell anyone. I could tell Alex, but no one else. And it was cool to have that secret for a while.
I bet that's a very big secret. And I think it would have been gone quite a different way if they'd used the Singer suit, even though it's for its time.
Yeah.
It was an interesting suit in that context to see that finally a real life Kingdom Come suit and to be worn by Brandon was just a fantastic moment in the Superman tapestry.
I always feel so bad for Brandon because when they cast him for television, when they cast Superman for the Supergirl TV show, with all due respect to Tyler, Brandon's the perfect guy. He's the perfect casting for that, and yet he was literally the last person on the list that Warner would ever have called for that job because of the movie. I would have stood a better chance of being hired for that, for the Supergirl version of Superman, than he would have been. So it always broke my heart that he was the perfect. So to be able to see him wear that Kingdom Come suit and step into the role one more time, and that made me feel a lot better for him.
Oh yeah, I mean, but it seemed like a medal of honor for him to get to put on the suit again and it not be the return suit. And I think the world has gone crazy making fan art and fan fiction, and people want Kingdom Come TV series and shows. I mean, it would be fantastic, but I think it's a dream that is very difficult to make happen, isn't it? To
create, it's very difficult. Yeah.
Whether it be a 5-hour film or a 2-season TV series. Don't get me wrong, I would love it. I would watch it till my heart's content, but it's just...
Sure.
It's a mammoth task to take on, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
But I mean, you know, this isn't just your only thing. I would like to know, though, as you mentioned just a moment ago, this wasn't your most favorite work. What is your most favorite work that you have done?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because I think it's in your other hand. I think that Birthright's probably my favorite thing I've ever written, because it's my love letter to Superman.
Certainly, it's from start to finish. And again, it's another book that is, when I did mention to a few friends that I would have the good fortune of speaking with you today, they said, please ask him about Birthright. I was like, don't worry. It's what I wanted to talk to him about. Because it is, as you said, it's a love letter to Smallville. It's got elements of all the classic Superman TV series. It's got homages to the Superman 78. And it's even got an intro from the creators of Smallville. Which what I loved about it, because Smallville is what got me in to Superman. So how did this one come to be? How did this wonderful book happen?
Publisher Dan DiDio came to me and said, we want to reinvent Superman's origin for the 21st century. And reinvent, I think he was looking for me to go a little bit more far afield than I went. But I just said, okay, let's just go and break everything down and rethink it for the 21st century. And my attitude is always... a very Hippocratic oath attitude. My attitude is do no harm. You know, don't break it if you can help it. You know, bend things if you need to bring them up to speed for the 21st century. Like making the Daily, that was the first time we saw the Daily Planet, not as exclusively as a print newspaper, but as an online news service, which had been picked up by other comics and other things, other iterations over the years. But that was the first time we'd seen that. So that's an example of bringing it into the 21st century without really changing as little as possible. And playing a little fast and loose with the Superman mythos. I mean, I hewed, my North Star is always the Silver Bronze Age Superman. That's the Superman I grew up with the Kents being dead, with Luther and him being friends when they were children. That's the Superman I grew up with. And I have a huge amount of emotional attachment to that. And I have reasons why I think that all those elements are good and are important as they are. That said, I wasn't just trying to do a Silver Age, homage with this book. I sat down and examined all of the elements of the Superman mythos. One of them was the Kents. In my vision of Superman, I think of the Kents as being deceased. I think that Superman from my point of view, the way I see the character and the way I tend to write the character, I think he works best the more alone he is, the more apart from humanity he is. And so his constant pain is trying to relate to humanity. His constant struggle is trying to fit in with the world. And the moment you give him too many people who know the secret, or too many people who are family that he can lean back on or have a casual conversation like that with, it somehow makes it less tragic. I mean, the tragedy of Superman is in that first movie, right? The tragedy of Superman is all my powers and I can't save him. The whole lesson of the first movie, all those powers and there's nothing I can do. And so the Kents passing away and Superman having no way of doing this, stopping this as a kid, that's the Superman in my head. That said, I understand why John Byrne wanted to bring the Kents back to life. And more importantly, I understand that entire generations of readers have been brought up with the Kents alive. So that was one of those cases where I thought, okay, do I go with what my gut is telling me, or do I accept the fact that whether I like it or not, there's good reasons for the Kents to be alive in Superman continuity? And so I went with the Kents being alive. Same with Luther as a businessman. I mean, to my mind, Luther is an evil scientist, not a businessman. That's very much of the 1980s. That's very, very much of the Wall Street era of Americana. And it's so overdone now by other villains that it's become cliched. But again, that said, that's the Luther that most people know. And so rather than dishonor what they know, or make readers feel like I'm changing too many things, I stayed with the Luther that's a little more familiar, the businessman Luther. There's, he's not exactly the John Byrne Luther, but on the other hand, the biggest thing I brought back into the Superman mythos with Birthright was the idea that Clark and Lex were friends when they were kids, which was not exclusive to Smallville. That was a big part of the Smallville TV show, but that's not where it came from. For me, it was very much of the Luther of the 1960s and 1970s. Elliot Magan has written two brilliant prose novels. I'm sure you know them, Last Son of Krypton and Miracle Monday. You've read these, yes?
Yes, sir.
And they're my Bible. Those two books are my two favorite Superman stories. Those two books are define Luther and Superman to me. And there's just so much mileage to get out of the idea that they were boyfriends, that they were friends when they were boys, that they connected because Clark felt so alone in the universe and there was nobody else in the world who was smart enough for him to be able to talk to about it and introspective. And in Smallville, there's no one for him to have a conversation with about this kind of stuff. And so Luther comes along, and as boys, they bond with the fact that finally, Kal-El has someone he can talk to about his experiences in a way that in a way that Ma and Pa could never understand. And then the tragedy of then losing that, the tragedy of screwing up, making your first big mistake as a superpowered kid and ruining Lex's life, not taking out his hair. I mean, that's silly. If you go back to the original stories, it was never just, I've lost my hair, so I hate you, Superman. It was, if you look back at the original stories, it was, here is this kid, this genius kid, Luther, in Smallville, who's a teenager, who using scraps and bits and whatever he can put together in this little hick town of Smallville, creates life in a laboratory, creates something that will make him known forever, creates something that validates his genius and all the pain that genius brings with it, and all of the emotional investment that he has in being smart, because that's the only thing he knows to be. And he creates life and Superboy accidentally extinguishes it. And that's what drove Luther over the edge. It's not the hair. It's the fact that you're jealous of me. I did this thing that no one else in the universe could do, and now I'll never be able to replicate it. And you did this because you're jealous of me. You hate me. That to me was the origin of Luther. That to me is a Luther that really resonates with me.
that is, you know, the origin of a super villain. That's how these relationships are built and destroyed. But yes, I as well love young Clark and Lex being friends and learning more about each other and experiencing life. But obviously for them to clash heads later down the line is always, it's going to be fun for me. And that is what happens in this book. And that, you know, there is fantastic character development from everyone, but not just the big names. You've also got some fantastic Perry White scenes and the Jimmies in there. And as always, Lois being a fantastically strong character. Lois in this is one of my favorite representations of Lois. She's just so much intelligent and sass and attitude. She's the full package. And what was it like writing these two iconic characters for your love letter to Superman?
It was great. I had a good idea of who Lois was in my head, you know, but it was, I was looking for that moment where Clark fell in love. I was looking for that, oh my God, moment when she, because we've never really seen that in any real depth. It's always just been, hey, she's cute. You know, I think I like her. Something bigger, you know, I needed some reason for Clark Kent to look at Lois Lane and have love at first sight. And it was, and so what I did was I went back to trying to figure out what that moment would be. And I remembered when I was working at a company once as an angry employee, because I'm not a good employee. I'm a much better freelancer. But the boss was a bully. The boss was a complete asshole. The boss was cruel. He was divisive. He was mean-spirited. He was petty. And I saw him once do something ridiculously stupid to another employee. And I just blew up at him. I screamed at him in front of everybody. And that was the loop. That was, I just ported that scene over into Lois. That's basically the same scene. Is that occurred to me that's the kind of thing that would make Clark sit up and take notice, is watching Lois stand up for the little guy, watching Lois stand up against, you know, bullying and hatred and pettiness and just basically standing up for somebody else. It's not, oh my God, she's cute. It's not, oh my goodness, she's, you know, she's terrifically talented. It's, my God, look at that person doing, you know, the thing that most people don't do, which is stand up to bad people. That's what made Superman, like, I mean, instantly, just boom, fall in love.
Yeah, and you could sort of, you do feel that romance in this book between them, for them blossom, and the chemistry and the private jokes that they have with each other. It's all in the book, and it all blends together so well. So how did you feel the day when this book was released onto the world, when people were able to read your story?
It was great. It was thrilling. I remember the very day that the first issue came out. It was diminished a little bit by the fact that for whatever reason, I want to say it's because Jim Lee had just relaunched the Batman books or something like that at the same time. We kind of got buried that week. It wasn't like the big DC launch of that week. It didn't quite have the, for whatever reason, whatever was going on in comics that week didn't have anything to do with this. And so we kind of got off on a bad foot that way. And I was always worried by the time we got to about halfway through the series, there was pressure on me to change what I was doing and do this or make it more of an Elseworlds or whatever. And I stuck by my ground. I stuck my guns and said, no, it's not an Elseworlds. It's not an alternate version of Superman. It's not supposed to be an alternate take on his origin. This is what you committed to. This is the new origin for Superman. And we pushed it through, and management didn't like it. The publisher was not a fan of the book. And so we didn't get a lot of press. We didn't get a whole lot of play. And I was afraid it would vanish. But when it came out in trade paperback, that's when things really started to move for that book. That's when people really started paying attention to it and buying it and buying it and buying it. And so that's what made it a bestseller. It was not when it was coming out on a monthly basis. It was scary when it was coming out on a monthly basis because it didn't feel like anybody was paying attention to it. And DC, it had no support from DC. It was when it came into trade paperback that people really latched onto it.
And I think that's one of the things, you know, it's the fans always at the end of the day, as you said earlier on, it's those people that are reading the comics. And it's why now, even after all these years, it is still, you can type in top 10 Superman comics, top 10 comics, or just top 10 stories. This book, as well as Kingdom Come, normally comes up. Yeah. You said it perfectly by saying it is a love letter to Superman, but it's not all the cliches there. There's
the mythos, there's a Superman tapestry. It's all in. And it's why it's certainly become my go-to Superman story. So thank you for that, first of all. I'm not sure when Comic-Cons are going to be coming back on the world so I can see you in person to say thank you. So this was my whole reason for getting a podcast with you, was to say thank you for your work for Superman. Because as you said, he's one of your favorite heroes. So hopefully, you know, you've still got some more Superman stories in you. Because I would love to hear them.
I do have some more Superman stories in me. I do, you know, whether or not they'll see the light of day, we'll see. But, you know, I think people who are excited about having you back at DC Comics will be happy with what's coming out when we start to announce things.
I'm always happy for new things. And if your name's attached to it, it's going to be a fun time. So for me, what I would love to know is, what has been one of your most proudest moments working in comics?
Wow. That's a great question. It's always, I think what comes to mind is not exactly one huge moment, but the same moment over and over again. The moment when people come up to me with Superman Birthright in their hands at conventions and say, I didn't like Superman until I read this. And now I understand Superman. And I like, those are always my proudest moments in all of comics. Because I feel like this is a character who I got a lot from as a kid. This is a character who meant a lot to me as a kid. And I was able to give back something of lasting value and lasting worth to that character. So that's something I'm very proud of.
And as you should be, that is a fantastic answer to that question. I'm glad you thought about it. And I mean, I do get rather upset, obviously, when people say that my hero is boring or Superman's an easy.
Right, exactly. Then I shove Superman Birthright at them and they will understand.
Read this and come back to me with that answer. I'm very glad for that. Yeah. But I mean, you know, it is. It's a character that means a lot to you. It means a lot to me and so many people all over the world. So, you know, we get defensive when people talk smack about our guys.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad that you went to the, I love that pettiness level of that. You made a classic book just to prove them wrong.
Well done. Right.
So what is next for you? What's going on in the world of Mark Waid?
Well, let's see. Well, I'm still publisher at Humanoids Publishing, which is a European publisher, very well known for 30 years, one of the biggest American or one of the biggest international graphic novel publishers, work with Jodorowsky and work with Mobius. And they've opened up an American branch about 3 or 4 years ago when I came on as publisher about a year ago. So that's a big part of my days is the day job of being the publisher at Humanoids and rolling out a bunch of new material starting later this year that we're really proud of, graphic novel stuff. But beyond that, you know, I still get a chance to freelance here and there. I still got plenty of time to do a little thing for DC or a little thing for Marvel here and there. And it's nice that people will still take my calls. That's very nice. I anticipate there being DC and Marvel work from me in the years to come without stopping.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, you've written a lot of the huge characters. You know, you've written for Superman, you've written for Captain America, two characters that are quite, you know, relatable in a way. How are these characters in your head? Do you sort of imagine them? Do you picture them working together or...
Oh yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I wish that, I mean, I don't think we'll ever see a DC Marvel crossover again because AT&T and Disney will never play nice with each other. But it's a shame because I've always had in the back of my mind a Captain America Superman crossover that has been in my back pocket forever. And I don't think I'll ever get a chance to use it. I mean, the hinge of it, without going into a lot of details, the structural, the fulcrum of it is not about Superman and Cap as much as it is about Steve Rogers and Clark Kent, because if you put them in opposition in the sense that Clark Kent is all about the truth and Clark Kent is all about reporting the truth and Steve Rogers is very protective of national security, you can see where there's a point at which these two would butt heads.
Mm.
And that was basically the little mustard seed that my story grew from. Maybe someday. Wouldn't that be awesome? I'd love to write that story.
We need to, I'm going to start crowdfunding this and see if we can make this happen. Because I can see it in my head. You know, you've got two very patriotic guys, both got good morals, both know when to cross the line when needed.
Right. But that's the one point of differentiation. That's when you're putting characters together like that, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for not only the ways that they're alike, but you're also looking for the ways they're different. And to me, the biggest way they're different is, again, the way Clark Kent, the reporter, approaches the truth versus the way that Steve Rogers, you know, Patriot approaches the truth.
Now I really need it. I don't want it. This has been in your head for years. So there we go. That's going to be fantastic. Well, I know you're a busy man. So first of all, thank you so much for all your time today. I do have
my pleasure.
One last question for you that I love when I get the chance to ask Superman creators this question. And that is, what does Superman mean to you?
When I was a teenager, when I was, you know, in 1978, I don't want to oversell this because it wasn't like I was living out of a cardboard box or anything like that. And I was shuttled back and forth between my mother and my father. They were split, and it was a very disjointed household situation. And it was through no one's fault. Everybody was doing their best, but I really didn't feel cared for. I didn't really feel like there was anybody out there who cared about me. I was a couple of years ahead in school because I'd been bumped up a couple of grades. So I didn't have any friends. I didn't really have any friends at all. And was very lonely and felt, again, very much like nobody cared. Like nobody cared if I lived or died. And I went to see Superman. I went to see Superman on January 26, 1979. And I saw it twice in a row. And when I came out of that movie theater, I knew that somehow, no matter what the rest of my life was going to be, it was going to have something to do with Superman. And it took me a long, long time to figure out why I responded that viscerally. And what I came to realize was that I went into that movie theater feeling like no one cared. And Superman cares about everybody. Superman, it doesn't matter whether you're young or rich or black or poor or, you know, wherever you, it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, Superman cares about you. And I felt that watching the movie. I felt that connection. I knew he was. I mean, I'm not insane. I know he's not a real person. I know but still, that touched me in a way that nothing else had done. And it was so important. It literally saved my life. Superman literally saved my life. And so that's what I mean when I say after that, I had to make sure that whatever I had to do with the rest of my life, I had to do with Superman. So that's what Superman means to me.
I've never cried on podcast before, but I came close. Yeah. That was beautiful. And I can tell that comes from the bottom of your heart because I have read your work over the years and will enjoy it for years to come. So again, for Superman fans all over the world and for Superman himself, I would just like to say thank you so much for everything you've done and will do in the future, sir.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
Where can people find you online, sir?
I am at markwade.com. There's a blog there that is not well kept up, but there's a lot of entries there in terms of if you want to break into comics, there's a lot of advice there. And beyond that, they can find me on Facebook. I have a Twitter account, but I don't pay any attention to it because I'm not an idiot and I don't want to. There's only so much negativity I can take in any given point of the day.
Yes, sir. I hear that.
Yeah. So that's basically where I can be found.
Super. Well, thank you so much. This has been an absolute honor. I wish you all the luck in the future, and I hope you get to make Superman stories, make Superman films, hopefully one day, and keep telling stories, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.